Hi, and welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Megan Figueroa.
And I'm Carrie Gillen.
How's it going?
Better. Yesterday, yeah. I started to feel like maybe I was getting bronchitis, and then I used an inhaler, and I feel better again than today. But I always feel better in the morning, so I don't know.
I always feel better at night.
Not with this, whatever this is.
I wake up and feel terrible usually with things. Yeah. Interesting.
Me too. Not at all with this one. Not at all.
Oh, could you imagine getting bronchitis from this right now when you don't want to go to the doctor? If, you know.
Yeah. Well, I almost always get bronchitis with anytime I get the flu. After I moved to Arizona. Before that, I never had it in my life. So something about the dryness of the air here, and I've been trying to sit with my face over a steaming bowl of water, but probably not doing it enough, frankly. So hopefully I nipped it in the bud.
Yeah, I'm still COVID free. And this was the first week where I felt emotionally transitioned into this new normal a little bit. So it's been a little bit better.
Okay, good.
People are still assholes. That hasn't stopped.
No, yeah, and in some ways they're getting more assholish, like full-on eugenics. Like,
yes, you've noticed that too? There's a lot of that happening.
There's a lot. I mean, it was already in the air before, like somehow eugenics was coming back, but it's just gotten worse in the last month.
Maybe because we're thinking about health issues and bodies. I don't know what it is.
It's because they want the economy to be back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want it to be okay that some people are going to die. And they've got it in their head that it's only people with pre-existing conditions and only people over a certain age. But that's not true. It's right. Mostly the case, but it's not 100% the case. So right. It's like anybody could die.
Right.
The good thing is probably the death rate is a lot lower than we think because there's just been so much under testing.
Wouldn't that mean there would be more?
A lot more cases, but the death rate's lower.
Oh, I see. Because the cases would go up. Got it.
Yeah. Yes. So it might be. So part of the problem is we don't know that all the deaths are being counted. So it's like the unfortunately, there's uncertainty in both things.
Right.
But the uncertainty is greater when it comes to the number of actual cases because the testing has been pitiful.
Yeah.
But anyway.
In the U.S. Anyway.
No, not just the U.S.
Really?
The U.S. is, one of the worst offenders, but no, the U.K.'s been bad. I mean, it's not great in most places.
Oh. Yeah. Well, all right. I know you all don't want to hear about Corona all the time.
Forever and ever.
Yes,
I know.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it's where we're at, and so we're going to be talking about it until, I don't know.
I mean, how could you not? My brain is, I'm not functioning the same way I was before.
No.
You know, it's always there, so I don't know how people, I mean, if you can't ignore it for some periods of time, that's great, and I can do that too, but it's I'm not the same. I can't think the same.
I have noticed that I've stopped freaking out when people are hugging and touching each other on TV shows and movies. But for the first week or two, it was really freaking me out. And now I'm like, oh, it's fine. Because we will get back to some, maybe not as touchy.
Right.
Maybe we won't shake hands anymore, which I think would be good because I don't really want to shake people's hands.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I feel like, oh, okay, well, some of this will come back. We will get there. It's just a matter of time.
Right.
So I'm feeling a little less stressed about just watching shows.
Oh my God. I didn't even think about that. Wasted my hours, some of my hours watching The Tiger King, and there was a lot of touching in that show, and I was like, that's not what's bothering me.
Oh, well, yeah, in that show, I have a lot of things to say about that show, but
that's on our other podcast.
I found it deeply unsettling, that show.
Yeah, so did
it. Got really dark.
Yeah, it did.
And there's a new episode coming out today, I think.
Yeah.
And even though I feel really dirty, I'm probably going
to
watch it.
I have to continue. It's I don't know. It's a little bit of my, the part of me that has to finish things that I've started. What am I saying?
Completist. You're a completist.
Yes. There. Okay.
I, I'm usually a completist. There are some things I have abandoned, but it's pretty rare. And yeah, so I'm feeling the same pull. I'm like, well, if there's another chapter, even though I thought that what the filmmakers did was kind of reprehensible.
Yeah,
I gotta watch.
Yep, I know.
Well,
anyway,
yes,
language stuff. So speaking of TV,
yes,
last night I was watching the part of the SNL. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I watched the news part.
The Weekend Update.
And first of all, it was very strange because no one could be in the same room together, right? Obviously.
Right. Oh, wait. And we talk about this kind of today in the episode about humor, about how things hit differently. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So actually, yeah, it's true. It's related to what we say about This Week Tonight. So yeah, it ties into this episode, but also the jokes land differently. But okay, with the news segment, what they did was they had a bunch of other people on the Zoom channel with them and they were all laughing. And it was really weird and distracting, and I hated it.
Yeah.
What I really hated was one of the jokes that Colin Jost told. I just re-listened to it, but I've already forgotten exactly what he said. But something like, Dr. Fauci is the first person in a long time that has a thick accent and is still smart. Or something like that. Yeah.
There's so many things wrong with that.
Yep.
For one thing, everyone has an accent. This thickness idea is like what?
It's fraught.
It's so fraught.
What does it even mean to have a thick accent? Please define it for
me. Yeah. And then what is like the opposite of that?
A thin accent?
I was going to say a skinny accent. What? I mean, how absurd, you know?
And then also, like, what does that say about his particular accent? So he's an Italian-American. He's got an Italian New York accent.
Right.
Which we don't hear that much anymore.
Right.
It doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, but it's not on television that much. Unless you want to code the person as...
A gangster?
A gangster or working class or both.
And so we have these preconceived notions about someone with his accent. Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely, yes. We do.
Yes.
General we, not like me and you, but like, you know.
No, well, we're susceptible to it as well.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. When I was younger, the only experience I had with anyone from New York would have been on TV, from TV. And so I definitely grew up thinking, you know, like they were all like the Sopranos. It's just so fucking irritating that Colin Jost has this, you know, platform and he is... using it to further this kind of accent-based discrimination that left-leading people are completely okay with still.
Yep, still. There's certain things that are still acceptable, and that's definitely one of them.
Yeah, you know people. There are a ton of people that we would probably consider, like, you know, people that we agree with on a lot of things are going to find no issue with that joke. In fact, they will laugh. They will laugh and think it's a good joke.
Yep. Well, they definitely were laughing on the Zoom room.
Oh, they were?
Yeah, so I was, like, very disappointed in many ways with that Weekend Update.
Yeah.
Anyway, today's episode is really fun. We talk about anti-hegemonic racial humor.
Yes, and we get to talk about Vine and lots of other fun things that I actually don't... I'm not a Vine person, so I was, like, happy to, like, learn about it, even though it's gone now, but...
You can still watch Vines.
It's true. Anyway, enjoy.
Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. It's free, and they have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. And you can also make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
So today, our guest is Kendra Calhoun, a PhD candidate at UCSB, who is interested in sociocultural linguistics, linguistic anthropology, language and race, online discourse and multimodality, humor and activism on social media, language attitudes and ideologies, youth language and culture, and African American language. Thank you so much for coming on, Kendra. We've been wanting to have you for a while.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have a paper out. It's called Vine Racial Comedy as Anti-Hegemonic Humor, Linguistic Performance, and Generic Innovation, which examines the discursive features and complex sociopolitical commentary of anti-hegemonic Vine racial comedy. So let's break that down. What are discursive features?
So discursive features basically is like a fancier way of saying characteristics related to discourse. Usually it's when someone's describing a particular type or genre of discourse, those are kind of the features or characteristics that they're focused on. So depending on what someone counts as discourse or like what they see as falling under that umbrella, those features could look a little bit different. So like for me, discourse can be written language, it can be speech, it can be sign languages, which I don't think anyone would really contest. But for me, discourse also includes like embodiment and visual communication, like images. So the discursive features I would include in something like I talk about in the paper might be different from what someone else might include. So it could, I talk about like phonological features, things like word choice, gesture, facial expressions. So those would all fall into the category of discursive features for me.
And what is anti-hegemonic humor?
Yes. Anti-hegemonic humor, as I came to understand it. So Ada Santa Anna has a paper from 2009 where he looks at the anti-immigrant jokes that Jay Leno makes in like a one night of his like stand-up comedy. So of course there's anti-hegemonic and then there's hegemonic humor. And basically the key distinction between those two is who's the butt of the joke, like who's the humor targeted at. So hegemonic humor is humor that targets already structurally or like socially marginalized groups. So jokes that target like people of color, queer people, poor people, homeless people, all of that would be hegemonic humor because by making those people the butt of the joke, you're upholding the status quo, upholding the systems where certain people already have structural and hegemonic power. So that's why it's hegemonic in that sense. So the flip side of that is anti-hegemonic humor, where the target or the butt of the joke is the people or the institutions or social structures that uphold power, have structural power. So anti-hegemonic humor would target like rich people, white people, politicians, anyone who has kind of that structural or existing power within society.
And what might be a mainstream example of anti-hegemonic humor?
One that I think is like a really good, really clear example of this is Patriot Act with Hasan Minhaj on Netflix, because he's using humor as like the means through which to make this social commentary about things like political corruption, you know, the government oppressing its people, wealth inequality, you know, corporations contributing to global climate change. So it's like humor is kind of the means to make this social commentary, but who is being targeted is very clearly people in institutions with power, and usually people who are abusing that power in some way.
Finish this sentence. Mm-hmm. Canada will not sell any more weapons to Saudi Arabia, period. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I missed that one. Canada will not sell any more weapons to Saudi Arabia, please.
That's a good statement. That's a good statement.
You said 9 months ago you guys would be examining it, mm-hmm. and it takes about 3 months to study for the LSAT, so that's a pretty good examination time. You could announce it right here, right now. We're canceling the deal.
We take our legal responsibilities and the breaking of contracts very seriously in this country.
So then would The Daily Show have been an example of this too? even with, well, with Jon Stewart and then now with Trevor Noah.
Yeah, so this, and kind of the, not necessarily the spinoffs, but shows that have been inspired by that. So like The Daily Show, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. Yeah, the kind of humor comedy news shows where, you know, they are making like really important like social commentary, political analysis, but it's based through humor as a way of kind of getting people to connect with that. Those are all really good examples. And stand-up comedy currently and historically has also been a really good source of this. I think now, especially that there are more women comedians, comedians of color, queer and trans comedians who are now being essentially given space that they've been denied. Like if you look across like Netflix and HBO, just the diversity of people who have like comedy specials has really expanded. And I mean, a lot of humor scholars have written about how people from marginalized backgrounds are more likely to include that kind of social and political commentary in their comedy and their humor. And so now that people from these groups are able to take the stage and make this sort of like commentary in their comedy, we're seeing it a lot more visibly or a lot more publicly than before. So I think that's really good to see.
I was just going to go back to Last Week Tonight, because this last episode was kind of interesting because there was no audience and it felt very serious, but at the same time he was still like making the same kinds of jokes, but they landed differently because there was no audience. Anyway, we just live in interesting times.
Really did. Like, he was making jokes about hamster on TikTok.
Yes, which we TikTok will get hamster. To.
Yes. But it's true that they land differently when you don't hear, like, the audience laughter or the reaction. It's really interesting. So you're talking about space opening up for more people to do, to have, like, Netflix shows and all of this. Does this... I'm guessing that anti-hegemonic racial humor has been around forever, but is this giving rise to that in a different way or giving it more of a platform?
I think, yeah, in some ways, yes. So to go back to your first point, anti-hegemonic racial humor, so many words, has been around for a long time. So Glenda Carpio has a book from 2008 called Laughing Fit to Kill, where she kind of traces this history of African-American humor from the time of enslavement. And she has actually a whole chapter on like Richard Pryor and Dave Chappelle. And she's also looking at different, you know, texts and literary forms, but how we can kind of trace this tradition essentially of using humor as a way of kind of coping and undermining structural power in these ways. But yeah, I think now there's more types of racial humor, or different ethno-racial communities, people with different ethno-racial identities are being able to create humor that's more specific to their experiences. So there's, of course, going to be some similarities, like where maybe not necessarily white people, but like whiteness or like white supremacy as a social structure is kind of a shared theme of what people are kind of making the target or the butt of the joke within this humor, but then grounding it in their very specific cultural experiences and usually very individual experiences of like what it was like growing up in their household, the neighborhood they lived in, what their family was like, things like that.
So how about Vine? So how did Vine producers use Vine to create this kind of comedy? And how is it different from other kinds of ways of making anti-hegemonic racial humor?
Yeah, so Vine, I am a self-described Vine groupie. So anyone who looks at my Twitter will see that that's in my bio. But yeah, one of the things that I loved about Vine was how creative people could be with it. On the surface, it seems really simple or almost like, you know, this 6-7 second limitation would really limit people's creativity. But I think in a way it kind of forced people to think outside the box and be creative in ways they wouldn't have otherwise. Yeah, so Vine has a lot of parallels with, or Vine comedy has a lot of parallels with like stand-up comedy, also sketch comedy in a lot of ways, since it is this kind of audiovisual platform. But in the article I talk about, I use the term like semiotically dense videos. Semiotics just referring to like meaning. So because the videos are so short, they basically have to use like any and every meaning-making resource that they have available to get the joke across in the short period of time. So using a lot of times there were multiple people in the video, so they could all be playing a different character. Sometimes one person might play multiple characters. They might have costumes on. They could use props. And Vine had the function where you could like upload a video that was already edited. So people could do sound effects, visual effects, voiceovers, add music. So there were lots of different resources people were using to make meaning in these videos. One thing that was really prominent, particularly in these like racial humor videos, was the use of stereotypes, which can be tricky, right? Because if someone doesn't have all of the kind of cultural or shared knowledge that you need to understand, like what's happening in the video, what the stereotype is supposed to be doing, it can be seen as reinforcing these stereotypes as opposed to the stereotypes being used as a way to kind of make social commentary or undermine kind of what these stereotypes supposedly tell us about these groups. And that did happen sometimes, right? You know, people are going to interpret these videos in different ways. But yeah, drawing on these kind of racial stereotypes, and because of the way race functions in the US and elsewhere, touching on race also means that you're going to touch on gender and class and education and language and, you know, lots of other things that happen. So one example that I really like, I talk about in the article, as one by King Batch called What They Hear When We Talk. I feel like it's just such a really good and clear example of like how this can kind of all come together.
How are you two fine gentlemen doing this evening? I was wondering if you'd like to,
hey man, I should decide what not your fat ass, bro. I can't like say you gonna give me your number, bro.
And that one, it's actually fairly, I don't want to say simple, but it actually doesn't use as many of these other resources that Vine videos often do. It's kind of three people standing in what looks like a parking garage is where this happens. And they're just kind of having a conversation.
Can you tell us then how, I'm guessing this is very language-based. How are they using language in this Vine?
Yeah. So one of the reasons I like this one is because, you know, there's lots of other ones where sometimes there's no dialogue at all. It's all very visual. And so that's where things like the costumes and the props come in. But in this one, it really is almost exclusively language-based, and there's a lot of embodiment that happens as well. But basically, it's King Batch, who's a Black man, and then there's two other white guys who are standing in this parking garage or wherever they are. And so they're also actors or collaborators on the Vine. And he walks up to them, you know, extends his hand for a handshake, and, you know, uses this kind of very formal, standardized way of speaking. He's like, how are you two fine gentlemen doing this evening? They shake hands. And then there's a perspective shift, which it's a thing that if you aren't familiar with Vines, you might not recognize right away, but you can kind of tell by the camera work and what happens that it's meant to be a change in perspective. And so basically the same interaction replays, but it's from the perspective of the white people now. And so King Batch is now using like morphological and phonological features of African-American vernacular English. But then it's also like really exaggerated. Like he's really loud now. His speech is kind of slurred. There's lots of profanity. And then also his embodiment changes. He's kind of like flapping his limbs around really wildly. And so the video in combination with the title, so this is something interesting that King Batch does a lot, is where like the title kind of tells you how you should interpret what you're viewing. So this title of What They Hear When We Talk sets up this dichotomy of like them being white people, we or us being Black people. Essentially, he's getting at this idea of like, no matter how quote unquote good or proper, no matter how standardized your language is, no matter how essentially like linguistically white you sound in an interaction, you're still always going to be viewed through the lens of what you look like. I can plug like H. Samuel Leem and Geneva Smitherman's book, Articulate Real Black, that looks at Barack Obama's speech and this kind of phenomenon of like, no matter what kind of structural power you have, like you can never kind of escape the way that people view you ethno-racially, phenotypically, linguistically. Yeah, so the idea basically being like you are always going to be expected to speak a particular way. And even when you don't speak that way, people still might perceive or interact with you as if you did. But then, yeah, at the same time that he's doing that in this, the second version, it kind of switches back and forth between King Batch and the two white guys who were there with him. And they're kind of making these expressions, like, almost like they're scared and confused and, like, just can't really figure out what's going on. So this idea of kind of, like, him just being this kind of, like, indecipherable, mumbling, bumbling kind of caricature, despite the fact that in reality he is this very polished, you know, speaking with very standardized English, doing this kind of, and a quote-unquote professional sort of interaction. And I think to kind of contextualize the ideology or the practices that he's trying to get at, it's the same idea as, like, if someone tells a Black person or another person of color after, like, a presentation or a speech, like, oh, that was really good, you were so articulate. This expectation, it sounds like a compliment, but it's grounded in this expectation that you wouldn't be able to articulate yourself clearly or wouldn't be able to express your ideas very well based on the fact that you are a Black person who they then expect to speak in this African-American vernacular English, which they would expect to be, like, unintelligible or just, like, less professional.
You use the word phenotypically, and just in case, what does that mean?
Basically physical appearance. You know, eye color, hair color, skin tone, physical build. Yeah, I won't get into all of the how does phenotype relate to the social construct of race, but basically the idea of, like, your physical appearance and how people map that onto ethno-racial categories.
And that's definitely something that is being used when people are announcing surprise by saying people are articulate. I am surprised by the way that you look and that came out of your mouth. But then this is King Batch is telling, you know, this, what is it called? What they hear when we speak is basically saying that you're damned if you do, damned if you don't, because there are going to be some people that still won't perceive you as articulate, quote unquote articulate. They'll still see it as stereotypical, or they'll hear something different than what is actually being produced.
Yeah. And it's related to this, in some ways, to this phenomenon of, like, imagined accents. I believe it was Carmen Fox who did that experiment where playing the same audio clip for students, but then based on, like, the picture or the image of the professor who was speaking, if the person was phenotypically looked East Asian, they said that the person was more difficult to understand, or they perceived them as having an accent. So, yeah, kind of our expectations based on people's physical appearances can, like, really drastically shape the way that we think that we hear them or perceive them, and then we actually interact with them accordingly.
Who was the audience for King Batch's Vines?
It's kind of a tricky question, because I think based on the content of the Vine, a lot of it is kind of, like, insider or, like, culturally specific Black humor. And so from that perspective, you know, you could kind of say, well, Black Vine viewers were kind of his primary audience, North American Black viewers, to be more specific. But I think this gets into kind of the same question as, like, stand-up comedians or sketch comedy, where even if that's maybe your target audience, that's not their only audience. And so as, like, content producers, I'm sure they're also very aware of kind of, like, the numbers, like, who is the largest numerically in terms of the population of people watching your video. So even if you're making content that would be most relatable to Black people or other people of color, that's not necessarily the only people who are watching. And something that was interesting with the Vine platform and phenomenon was the way that it functioned kind of as, like, a launching pad for a lot of people. So a lot of the really popular content creators were on there. You know, they liked Vine, they had community there, but they were also, like, very publicly, like, trying to become known in the entertainment business. They wanted to be actors, they wanted to be producers, they wanted to be models or whatever it was. So it was this kind of, like, dual function of, like, oh, I get to express myself creatively, but then I can also use this as a way to essentially gain celebrity, become famous or well-known in some way. So I think that's kind of something I'm always keeping in mind when I think about kind of who they're making these videos for. And I think it was probably different earlier on as opposed to later, like when Vine was really just kind of picking up and it really was just kind of this creative community platform versus once people started getting famous from it.
Is King Batch doing anything now outside? Because Vine no longer exists, right? So Is he on a different platform now? Is he still doing his comedy?
So before he was on Vine, he had a YouTube channel where he did kind of like sketches on there. As far as I know, that's still going on. I know he still had it like after Vine shut down. He's also been on, so Nick Cannon has a show on MTV called Wild and Out, which has a bunch of different comedians on there. So he's been on there. He was actually kind of a guest character on To All the Boys I've Loved Before on Netflix.
Really?
He plays, I don't remember his name, but he plays like a friend of the Peter Kavinsky. Yeah. He plays one of his friends, which I was kind of struck by because he was like, you know, they always cast people who are older for like high school and college, but I was like, he feels, to me, he felt like noticeably older than the other characters, but
yeah,
that's beside the point.
Someone was a fan. Someone was like, we need to have him here. I want to meet him.
Yeah, I was really surprised to see him in there, but you know.
Yeah.
The character that he plays in that film is pretty on brand. I think he has like a, probably has an Instagram channel as well.
Oh, right, Instagram.
Yeah. And then someone told me recently now that he's on TikTok.
That's what I was expecting.
But that's so different, right? Because that's what, like, three times as much time?
It's a minute.
What Vine had? Oh, a minute. Oh, I thought it was, like, 24 seconds or something like that. Wow.
No, a minute, yeah. You know, you can be shorter.
Sure, yeah. Wow, that would be a lot of discursive features, wouldn't it? You also talk about GIFs or GIFs. Or GIFs, as my mom says, because she doesn't want to say either one.
That's hilarious.
I'm like, wow, that's the cleverest cop-out I've heard in a while. Can you tell us a little bit about how they're used and how they're doing similar things as Vine videos?
So I'm team GIFs. So I'd say that GIFs and Vine videos, I think, have a lot of similarities in terms of structure. Kind of what they look like visually. But I think they're functionally, I think they're doing slightly different things. Reaction GIFs, as I see them being used and kind of as different like media scholars and stuff have talked about them, in order for them to be kind of widely used, they have to be like decontextualized. So you might look at them and know where the original, you know, film, reality TV show, music video, wherever it originally came from, but that's not necessarily relevant to how the GIF is used. Like there's a couple where having that, more than a couple, there's some where having that extra information kind of makes it funnier how someone uses the GIF, but you don't necessarily have to know that in order to use it. But I think with Vines, especially the kind of like hashtag relatable ones, when those were really popular, people were doing this kind of like slice of life, let me show you something that happens that everyone can relate to. So actually the titles or the captions for the videos would be when whatever happens, when X happens, when blank happens. And so they were similar in terms of like being in response to a specific situation, the way that you use reaction GIFs. But Vines generally have like some sort of kind of plot or storyline to them, or there's some sort of action that happens. You can at least kind of say like there's a beginning, middle, end, or beginning and end. One that I think of that is just, it's this kind of like absurdist Vine humor that existed in parallel with this like very making serious social commentary kind of Vine humor. So Also by King Batch was called, if I remember correctly, it's called like when you trip and your spaghetti falls out your pocket, and it's literally just him, and he like walks out of an elevator or something, and he trips and falls, and then like a bunch of spaghetti falls out of his pocket, and then the last couple seconds are just him kneeling on the ground holding this spaghetti in his hands. And so, you know, if you wanted to turn that into a reaction GIF, like you could take like the last couple seconds where he's kneeling on the ground crying and holding the spaghetti. But again, in order for that to become like a reaction GIF, you're having to like decontextualize it from the rest of the video. But I do think that this idea of making a whole Vine video that captures a reaction to a specific moment or interaction is definitely kind of like in dialogue with what people are doing and have been doing with reaction GIFs, if that makes sense.
So what does Vine tell us about comedy more generally, do you think?
I think Vine shows us that, and this isn't like a novel claim, but that comedy and that humor more broadly is always in dialogue. It's never created in isolation. Because I think, as I talk about in the article, right, when you look at Vine, particularly this racial comedy, you can see this through line of stand-up comedy, of sketch comedy like Key and Peele, of, you know, now we can kind of see continuations of this after Vine, things like A Black Lady Sketch Show or Astronomy Club on Netflix, that all of these things, they address similar issues in slightly different ways, but also just some of the conventions of like the language they use, the types of characters they portray. We can really see these connections. Vine also shows us like how creative people can be working within these same genre conventions. I think when people are given different types of tools, that they'll find very unique ways to use that to meet these similar sorts of social goals. And I think that's one of the things that I just absolutely love about Vine so much, was seeing all of the different ways that people could use the same tools from this platform to create such drastically different things from each other, or very similar things to each other, but everyone had their own kind of unique flavor or take on it. And then also something that seems on the surface to be so structurally very different from something like stand-up comedy. When you really like get into the meat of it, you really see how similar these things are. So yeah, I think Vine shows us that kind of that through line for comedy.
And you were a Vine groupie. Have you hopped over to TikTok?
That's always the question that comes up. And as of yet, I have not. I have.
Is there a reason for that?
Not necessarily. At first I was kind of on the like, oh, TikTok is just trying to be the new Vine, but like, it'll never be the same. It'll never be as good. And then mostly it was like, I don't have time to look at TikTok.
Watch a minute.
Yeah. As much as I like truly loved watching Vines, it really was like a time intensive thing in order to kind of like really understand just all of what was happening on that platform. But I do see TikToks. I see them on Twitter. I see them on Instagram. So I am familiar with kind of what people are doing, you know, the dances, the different types of memes that people create. I know that there are TikTok teens who are now famous and going all over the place. Eventually I will get over there. The more that I'm seeing, I think there's a lot of, I guess I could call it parallel analyses to be made. Right, because you could immediately identify whether something was a Vine or a TikTok, even if you hadn't spent a lot of time on the platform. So even if you see a TikTok that's like 6 seconds long, you could look at that and say, no, that's a TikTok and not a Vine. It might be kind of like an intuitive thing at first. Like you might not be able to pinpoint it. I think I could pinpoint it.
You could. No, you definitely could.
And so that's something I think is really fascinating, especially thinking about particularly like really young teenagers who are on TikTok right now might not have been part of kind of the Vine phenomenon at all.
Yeah, right.
But there are people who were on Vine and then went to TikTok. And now actually there's a platform called Byte that was released recently by one of the creators of Vine. People are calling it essentially Vine 2.0, but it's the same structure of like I think it's six seconds, the looping structure. A lot of people who were on Vine are on that platform now, and people are already using a lot of the same sort of popular sound effects and kind of video effects, video structure. And then when it first came out, there were a lot of videos that were basically like, this isn't TikTok, don't post your TikToks here. So this kind of like adversarial relationship already, which is kind of
interesting. It's called
Byte? Byte.
Like B-Y-T-E? Oh, B-Y-T-E. Okay. Again, with the 6 second limitation, and for some Vine producers, language is really, really crucial. What can your paper tell us about language in general?
I think one thing that's really telling with Vine and King Batch, and also just kind of like comedy more broadly, is that even when people don't have a kind of academic lens on language, everyone is still very acutely aware of how our language use helps us or hinders us in navigating our social worlds, the ways that other people interact with us and we interact with other people based on our language practices, right? Because like this, what they hear when we talk is based in the reality that, you know, people have expectations of Black people based on how we speak, that Black people style shift and code switch and are able to speak multiple varieties, but people don't always necessarily recognize that. But yeah, I think that broadly speaking, it shows us that, I mean, language as a way that people, I guess, as a proxy for race and all these other social characteristics that people can use to discriminate against each other, but also particularly through the lens of comedy, that language becomes a tool for bringing attention to these social problems and social phenomena, and language as a tool for combating them or undermining them. And so I think that's also kind of a common thread through things like, you know, Patriot Act and Last Week Tonight and all these different stand-up comedians, is like they're using their linguistic repertoires, you know, whatever that looks like, in order to share stories and, you know, make commentary about things that happen to them and other people, but also talk about, like, what can we do about that? What does it look like to change the situation? What would, how do we imagine, you know, a society or an interaction that goes differently? And a lot of that is through language, yeah, and embodiment and kind of, you know, all these other things that go with it. And I think especially through humor, and I've seen this like in teaching and just in conversation, is that because especially in the US, like race and racism is such a touchy topic that people either don't want to talk about or are afraid to talk about because they feel like they'll say the wrong thing and they don't want to come off as being racist or be called racist and just kind of, you know, all of that that goes with it. I feel like humor kind of helps to take the edge off a little bit. You know, so if someone can kind of bring attention to something you said, but frame it as like a joke of like, oh, haha, next time maybe don't use that word, or be careful about the way that you frame that, or, oh, actually, there's a history to this word that makes it kind of problematic. So it feels less like I am directly targeting you as an individual who did this thing, and more so like, oh, I'm making general commentary about this word or this way of interacting with each other. And I think particularly in kind of like more intimate or like close interpersonal relationships where that can get really tricky, being able to like point to someone else's comedy bit, yeah, or sketch and say, hey, like maybe watch this yeah, couple minutes of comedy and maybe you'll have a better understanding of like why that's not a good thing to do, or, you know, how we can go about, I don't know, changing our behaviors. Because I think a lot of times comedians, sometimes subtly, sometimes not so subtly, really are making suggestions for like, how do we change our behaviors? How can we be more cognizant of the way that we interact with people? And a lot of stand-up comedy and Vines too are kind of not imaginary, but they're imagining or they're constructing these situations that might not have happened, or kind of replaying like how I would have liked something to go if I had a better, you know, answer at the moment, or could think on my feet at the time. And so I think that is this really interesting creative practice of like reimagining our social worlds and what they could look like. So that's one reason that I personally really love comedy and other forms of humor.
I like the point that you made earlier, Kendra, about how like maybe it's a way for people to like see what they're actually doing without, you know, in a softer way, like, haha, isn't this a funny thing? And then you think about it and you think, oh man, maybe I've done that. Maybe I should stop doing that. And you don't feel so directly attacked, which we know people are sensitive. and so it's actually a really smart strategy for anti-racism or anti-whatever-ism. And I think, obviously, maybe this should be obvious to us, but I don't think it always is obvious to us what humor is actually doing, because we're just laughing in the moment.
And that is kind of the humor I gravitate towards too. Like Last Week Tonight, I watch things like that all the time. And do you think that social media too can tell us something similar, or can function similarly to humor as humor does?
Especially as far as the platforms that I'm on a lot. So Twitter and Instagram are my big two right now. I think Twitter in particular is a really good example of how social media can have these similar sorts of functions, especially thinking about how much of social media discourse is meant to be humorous in some way or another. So thinking about something like Twitter and just the number of like videos and GIFs and memes that people post, visual memes, textual memes. But how much of that, especially in, you know, a moment like this, is tied to or based around like social issues, political issues. You know, coronavirus has already been turned into a meme. but, you know, people are using it as a way to spread information, or as I've seen some people call it, like crowd shaming, saying like, you know, if you go out to that bar, Miss Rona is going to be at the bar too, and Miss Rona is going to come home with you. And, you know, using it as a way of like pointing out like, this is, we can use humor to like make very important points of like, this is serious. You shouldn't be going out to bars. You know, you could contract coronavirus and take it home and infect other people. And people doing that with, you know, political figures, people doing that with, you know, police officers. Oh, you know, there's always something happening in the news. You know, I'm thinking more specifically of like Black Twitter and how it's, again, this kind of long standing tradition of like using humor to bring attention to these social issues, a kind of, as we say, like a laugh to keep from crying kind of practice. But I think another thing with social media, even regardless of whether or not what someone's posting is humorous, is a lot of times social media is where people turn to find community, to find resources, to, you know, access people and information they might not otherwise connect to in their day-to-day life. Like they might not be able to turn to their family or their neighbors or the people who are kind of immediately around them. And from what I've seen and, you know, what people have studied, people will share a lot on social media, particularly if it's anonymous. So I think it offers this kind of window into seeing what people are really dealing with in their day-to-day lives. Kind of sometimes it's more of just, here's a thing that happened to me, but also sometimes talking about how they combated experiences of discrimination or talking about like the resources that they need to get through the issues that they're facing. And so I think, you know, someone who's on social media a lot, I'm kind of absorbing that, but you can also do it very kind of strategically of like getting on a social media platform and scrolling through or searching for specific key terms and see what people are talking about and learning in that way. So yeah, I think it has some similar social functions in that way of kind of sharing information and doing so in a way that points to kind of larger structural issues as well as more localized and individual kind of experiences.
I like that idea. I mean, of kind of cultivating empathy. Like this is what we have access to, more people's lives in this way that they're willing to share, then it can help us cultivate empathy for other people.
Yeah, and I definitely think it works. I mean, obviously there are people on there who are just not going to give two shits about anybody else, but I have definitely seen people change their minds about things because they're like, oh wait, this is really happening. Like I the first time I saw someone talk about it on Twitter, I didn't believe it. The 10th time I saw it, I was like, oh, this is real. I've seen it with, like, you know, sexual assault. I've seen it with violence against Black people. I've seen people actually change their minds. So, and it's helped me. Like I have learned some things that I would not have known otherwise without Twitter in particular, less so other social media.
I know for me, being on Twitter, like, you know, I started following a lot of like disability activists, mm-hmm. even like within linguistics Twitter, following more people who do deaf studies and sign languages and thinking about issues of accessibility. And so, absolutely. Yeah, for me, just thinking about in my day-to-day life, in my teaching, the language that I'm using, but also like how am I structuring my lessons, you know, am I including sign languages? Am I including non-Indo-European languages? Just thinking, yeah, just making me think reflexively and critically about kind of my own social practices. Even if I didn't doubt that, you know, ableism and things like that existed, really seeing it put into concrete terms and seeing
exactly,
kind of how
yes.
I could be participating in that in my own day-to-day life that I didn't realize, and kind of, yeah, opening my eyes to changes that I can make. And as I was saying before, not feeling like I'm being attacked as an individual, but saying, oh, people right. are talking about this because it's a common thing.
Yeah.
So that means
yeah.
me and a bunch yeah. of other people have some changes yeah. that we need to make.
Yes.
And how can I start yeah. doing this on an individual level?
Do you have one last message for our listeners?
I don't know. I guess now that we're all hopefully doing some social distancing, I guess my message would be to watch some good comedy. See if you feel like it's hegemonic or anti-hegemonic, why you feel that way. Think about kind of what's the takeaway message from that. Is it something that you can adopt in your own life? Have you learned something new from watching this comedy? I guess that's something that my students always tell me, because I always incorporate like comedy and social media and all this kind of stuff in my teaching. And they're like, this is really cool that we can, you know, apply this to what we see in our everyday lives. But now we like can't unsee it. Like, I can't just watch comedy yes. anymore.
Right.
We've talked about this before, how like once you know something, it's really hard to just watch a movie. Like, yeah. you're just like, yeah. oh, what message is this giving me?
But I think comedy is one of those things where, even while you're aware that there is or might be this kind of important sociopolitical message, like, you can still enjoy it.
Oh, because
it
for
always
sure. kind
of, it always fluctuates, right? Like, it's not like 40 minutes straight of like really intense
right.
Social commentary. You know, it switches between being really lighthearted, sometimes being kind of absurdist, sometimes it's crass. But in the end, a lot of times you get this a really good kind of takeaway message.
Thank you so much for this. This is a really fun conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
And I didn't start coughing.
I know. You suppressed it for an hour. It's great. wait for another 4 hours.
Oh, God. Anyway, let's all tell our listeners, don't be assholes.
Don't be an asshole. And stay healthy.
Stay healthy.
While not being an asshole. Thank you, Kendra.
Yeah, thank you.
We would like to thank two new patrons for this month.
Yay!
Daniel Greeson.
Thank you, Daniel.
And Duncan Wayne.
Duncan, thank you. Oh, two D's.
Two D's.
Yes. Duncan and Daniel.
Yeah, and just as a reminder for those of you who want to support us, I know it's hard in this time, but we both are underemployed, so anything you are able to help us with is greatly appreciated.
Yes.
You can support us at the $2 level, the $3 level, where you get stickers, or the $5 level, where you get stickers and bonus episodes.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at VocalFriesPod. You can email us at VocalFriesPod@gmail.com, and our website is VocalFriesPod.com.